Okay. There are two major strands of development in American art music after World War I is over. Those of you who've been writing on Conversations by Aaron Copland are well aware of one of them. The other I will devote sometime today, this experimentalist tradition, which in fact culminates in Trump. The neoclassical tradition, however, was equally strong and vital, and includes in its membership, so to speak, not only Aaron Copland, but as well Elliot Carter, and a number of other composers, even up to the present time, I would argue. Copland, of course, as you know, who are writing on his paper, on his composition, Copland found his first American voice by drawing upon rhythmic aspects of early jazz, ragtime, in fact. But this interest in elements of jazz style did not continue a long time. In fact, it did not outlive the 1920s, make no mistake. Copland did not have a thorough and complete understanding of jazz. Many European Americans in the North didn't. What is dumbfounding to realize is that Copland, in a sense, in terms of jazz, is more culturally isolated than the French composer Darius Milhaud or Maurice Ravel. Both of whom came to America, both of whom actually went to Harlem, the principal black community of New York City at the time, went to the clubs, heard the music by its African-American originators. Copland's approach to jazz was through the intermediaries of other Jewish American composers, actually songwriters such as Irving Berlin. To Copland, Alexander's Ragtime Band and other ragtime songs by Berlin and other Tin Pan Alley composers was to Gil McCoy. In truth, they were derivative. And why this is startling is because, as those who are writing in Copland know, the rest of you should, he was a New Yorker. He was born in Brooklyn. He wasn't in Brooklyn. He lived in Manhattan. Harlem was in Manhattan. How far away do you need to be before you don't know these things? He knew it in Paris, he didn't know it in Brooklyn. Sure. The neoclassicism of America had all of the characteristics of French neoclassicism, Stravinsky neoclassicism. Undeniably tonal, clear, transparent textures, very economical in character, and nothing more encapsulates all of these than his piano variations of 1930.
Six years after the piano variations, Copland turned based upon objective elements sufficient unto themselves.
Remind us of 18th century genres of variations. But you should note that the experimentalists not only reject the post-romantic supremacy of Central Europe, they reject neoclassicism as well, in which they say, in no uncertain terms, it's basically selling out to European cultural domination. Okay? It's not Germanic, it's French, but that's no better. You're still not really seeking an American expression. You're seeking now a full French expression, neoclassical expression, instead. They wanted an American artistic expression purified of any European influence. Curiously enough, one of the most harshest critics of neoclassicism was a French immigrant to America, Edgar Varèse, who said that neoclassicism was zealously academic and a block to genuine creativity. Henry Cowell called neoclassicism in America a curiosity, and said any composer who pursued it was, quote, a composer who has been a modern in the vanguard and who later renounces modernism in an attempt to reduplicate a bygone style. An attempt to reduplicate a bygone style. That bygone style being the classical roots of neoclassicism. The bygone style of the 18th century. Cowell, Varèse, Cage, and others wanted a genuinely modern style that was essentially cut off from any precedent in the past. Cut the ties entirely. You know, it's a case of, or get off the can, so to speak. You can't do both. In this case, begins with a silent S. Henry Cowell, for one, introduced a new agenda for the experimentalists that resonates not locked down to the music of George Crumb, among others. It was a quest for new sonorities, new sound, new timbre. And in order that to accomplish this, his first source of new sounds was the piano itself. Where are the new sounds to be found on a piano? Not on the keys, but within the instrument itself. By suppressing the damper pedal and opening up all of the strings to sympathetic vibration, and then strumming them, you have something that cannot possibly be replicated on keyboard. For example. And indeed, we find a series of compositions by Henry Cowell that explore the potential of new timbres from within the instrument, not in front. And the composition that he wrote, entitled The Banshee, also introduces us necessarily to a new approach to notation. Because the former is going to be strumming strings, not playing. Cowell used this composition, one of several, to demonstrate a variety of potential attacks. It's not enough to strum the strings. How shall you strum the strings? And what else might you do in addition? The Banshee, which as you can see, is a character piece. One page character piece. It looked like that Bagatelle of Beethoven was a one page character. But what is necessary to realize Cowell's intentions is to interpret a set of instructions, a set of symbols that he included in his notation, to talk about various kinds of strumming, to sweep with the flesh of the finger from the lowest string to a particular pitch, like so. Alternatively, to use the fingernail, to strum along the length of the string. Like that. To pluck a string, in the manner of plucking the string of a guitar or a banjo. Versus using the flesh. Something that has a slightly different effect. Charming about this particular recording, which is the original recording by Henry Cowell himself, made in 1925, is the very serious presentation of the title of the work by the composer before the piece begins.
The Banshee.
In effect, begin. symphony, it's not a sonata, it's in one movement. It is clearly devoted to the exploration of the sonorities of the ensemble's confinement. And that is sufficient. John Cage, an extraordinarily powerful musical intellect, very diverse in his engagement with experimentalism. He too, inspired by Varese's example, composed works for percussion ensemble in the later 1930s, or works for percussion in which a single percussionist, in a sense, provided the entire content of the composition. A series of compositions called Construction, First, Second, Third Construction, are examples of this work. And his new sonorities not only included what we might think of as a wide array of conventional percussion instruments, such as might be found within an orchestra, but as well new sources such as the brake drums from automobiles that have their own distinct timbres, and which he incorporated into these elements, thus producing even broader sonorities. Why percussion? Because they're struck now. They have a sort of a bell-like quality to them, and a very interesting addition as well. So we have with John Cage the notion of discovered sounds, or found sounds, sources of which are not the conventional instruments, but which are used as if they were, and which enlarge our sense of the scope of possibilities. Cage was also interested, after World War II, in the discovery of additional sonorities from the piano, including the notion of preparing an instrument. A prepared piano is one in which, following very careful directions, different strings are partially muted, or material is placed upon the strings so that when the keys are struck, the consequence is a different kind of timbre than would otherwise be the case. An example of this, nothing more elegant than a pen. Transformation of sound possible. And for Cage, It opened up all sorts of possibilities, as did other kinds of inventions. For example, a composition in which, staged in New York City, in which a number of radios, each with its own person adjusting the dial and another person adjusting the volume, were assembled on stage. You could only do this in a place like New York, perhaps, with all the radio stations. And the resulting effect was the different sounds coming from the radios, as some would be brought out through raising their volume, and then others attuned to different frequencies and therefore in different programming would appear or emerge. One of his compositions from 1952, called William's Mix, is such a composition. The simplest definition of the work of art is that it has influence in music. is an object that is presented for contemplation on its own, non-functional. We think of radios as a means of communication. We are concerned with not with the static that's in between the stations, which is what people do among the parties, but the content of the programming on the station itself. Gage, in fact, says, radios can themselves be a source of sonority, a sound, a timbre, and their combinations can be the stuff of composition. I wanted to, in fact, replicate one of these words here as part of the effective recital. The only trouble is there's so much damn concrete, we cannot get any radio signals in here. We have to somehow figure out a way to get an antenna outside and then see what we can figure out for a 5 minute AM office. This is unfortunate. Now, we come to George Crumb. George Crumb is the heir, the inheritor of these impulses. Those writing on Crumb's Macrocosmos 3 know of the diversity of sounds implicit in his use of the two pianos and the array of percussion he has selected for inclusion in that composition. Native of Charleston, he was apparently very acutely sensitive to the sounds that he heard in the Kanawha River Valley. What would those sounds have been? Well, in addition to traffic noises, they would have been the sounds of the railroad. Chesapeake and Ohio was then the main line that runs through the southern part of the state, from Huntington on the west, Charleston, up the New River to Hinton, across the mountains by the Greenbrier, and on into Virginia. These are train whistles. These are the sounds of the engine. These are the rattling of the cars. In addition, sounds on the river itself, the echo of sound in the valley. He was acutely responsive to these, as well as to all of the musical experiences of his family. Let me add a cautionary note to those who were writing on Crumb. Crumb had as much access to musical culture as anybody in the country who did not live in a big city. Do not make a mistake. He was listening, able to listen to live music from the New York Philharmonic and the Metropolitan Opera, the recordings that his family acquired, whatever live local performances there were. True, he did not have access to the modernist experimentalist music being made in his youth in New York or in his teenage years in New York or elsewhere. That is true. But that's what he was cut off from, if anything. He was certainly well versed in the traditions of European and American art music up to the time of World War I. That could be little about what happened thereafter. The quest for new sounds and new modes of expression define Crumb's repertoire. Crumb is part and parcel of the experimentalist tradition, and his quest for new sounds also obviously has made him something of a multiculturalist, as he has brought in instruments and timbres from other musical cultures than those of the Western world. He's included musical cultures that lie below the radar of Western art, folk traditions to some extent. But certainly his use of Tibetan and Japanese instruments, named by two examples of Asian musical culture, simply are an enlargement of this quest for sonority. As Aaron Copland put it in a lecture of 1951, when he was Norton Professor of Poetics at Harvard University, an honorary lectureship, collectively known as Music and Imagination, with the title of the lecture series. The challenge facing any American composer, Copland argued, quote, has been to find models for his or her music. Something Copland referred to as a usable past. A usable past meaning, what do you build your own musical traditions upon? For Mozart, for Haydn, for Brahms, for Wagner, the usable past was the immediate previous generations of Europeans, the Central Europeans. For Americans, especially those wanting an American tradition, an American sound, the question is more vexed. Especially if you're trying to minimize the impact of Europe in your quest for something that's American. And as I have suggested, Crumb drew his musical style. Yes, the European art music, of which he was made familiar thanks to his family's immersion in and commitment to art music performance, that were both members of the Charleston Symphony, and have accumulated a very large collection of scores in the course of from youth. The American vernacular musics of the Kanawha Valley. Again, rich material. What's left of the folk traditions in southern West Virginia? And I say that deliberately because the notion that there is a living oral tradition of American folk music is an extremely dubious proposition. Especially when you find some of the best fiddlers showing up at fiddle contests in West Virginia who were born in Long Island, New York. I mean, I ask you. The fiddle tradition of Long Island, New York is not a very deep or extensive one. How would they learn fiddle? They listen to the recordings, the commercial recordings. They heard other fiddlers who were reared perhaps on a master fiddler of the past with his own style to trace influences of others. And as I've said, non-Western musical traditions of which I have listened to. The result is a highly individual style. The Crumb's compositions were coming forth with great regularity in the 1960s and 1970s, particularly. People were confident that what they were hearing would not be mistaken for any other composer's music. Subsequently, his influence is such that many of his strategies and gestures do turn up in the music of later generations. This highly individual style is perhaps captured no better composition, which represents a high point in Crumb's career than his 1970 work, Ancient Voices of Children, for soprano and mixed chamber ensemble. By mixed chamber ensemble, I mean a variety of instruments that do not represent a typical string quartet, wind quintet, brass ensemble, and so forth. It includes oboe, a variety of percussion, pianos. Somebody who's prepared to play a musical saw. Somebody who's prepared to play a band. None of these instruments is selected to be a prominent solo instrument. They're all part of an ensemble. Their distinct colors emerge when we see. Ancient Voices of Children is a curious name for a composition. You put notions of ancient and children together, you have almost an inherent composition. The music begins with a score of extraordinary character. The very first move. This is Crumb's own musical notation. This is not finale or sedate, this is Crumb's own hand. Everybody plays from a score. You don't have to count measures, count rests. You just watch and wait for your part to begin. Dominating this opening movement is the soprano soloist, for whom he wrote the music, Dante Gaetano. The text begins, El niño busca su voz. The little boy was looking for his voice. It continues, El rey de los grillos, la niña. The king of the crickets. When a singer looks for his or her voice at the beginning of an occasion for performance, what does such a performer do first? To warm up the voice. Singers among us, we know who you are. What do you do first? What do you do? Come on, come on. I'm sorry? What do you do? Do you not vocalize? Do you not vocalize? Yes? I mean, you don't pick up the Queen of the Night aria and start singing it at full performance voice. You don't do it. You vocalize. You look for your voice. You ensure that your voice is ready to function from the bottom to the top of its range, from the loudest to the softest. You do it with vowels. You do it with different melodic fragments, repeated again and again, perhaps in sequence, up and down, whatever, right? My life? Yes. Though startling when you first hear it, what you hear in the opening movement of Ancient Voices of Children is a very modernist vocalist in which Dante Gaetani stands at the curve of the piano, sings into the piano, the pianist is seated there with the dampers open, and what she sings causes those strings to resonate and provide an ambiance behind it. Her voice includes all sorts of sounds that every one of us has made at one time or another, for fun, to irritate our parents, whatever. Crumb has brought them into the performance as a way of creating a modern vocalese, a modern search for one's voice. And the result is an extraordinary tour de force. Stage or soprano.